and welcome to Batman Nightcast, a proud part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. I'm Chris Franklin.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
In this episode, we're taking a brief break from our coverage of Batman & Robin Year One to discuss a unique Batman story, both in pedigree and format. And for that, we need a unique special guest with a pedigree all his own. Please welcome fellow FW All-Star and the host of Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast, Mr. Sean Ross. Welcome to Stately Wayne Manor, Sean.
Hey, this is awesome, guys. I've always wanted to visit. I'm going to go check out behind the grandfather clock. You think I dropped something back there? That's okay, right?
Right, right. You got to know the exact time to set it to or it won't open, you know. So yeah.
Oh my God, is the code for the grandfather clock set to the time his parents died in Crime Alley? Because that is crazy morbid. I've never thought about that.
Yeah, it is actually, yeah.
Oh my God. I mean, thanks for having me on the show, guys. I've learned something new in the first 2 minutes that makes Batman even more depressing. Awesome.
Now, Sean, you are known on your podcast for asking many questions, including secret ones. But we'll start out with one that's pretty easy and you probably expected. So what's your history with Batman?
So like many people our age, I first discovered Batman on my underwear. I had the underoos, I had Batman, I had Superman, had some off-model ones, Captain Marvel, whose arm shot off. My parents were poor, so we took what we could get. And, I watched Super Friends, Batman 66, you know, the lunchboxes, the thermoses, had everything. And then I first started collecting comics, I bought G.I. Joe. And then my first branch out from G.I. Joe was to Batman. And I was homesick one day. My mom had to go to work. She felt guilty because she was leaving me home alone when I was really little. And she's like, can I get you something? And I said, yeah, can you get me some comic books? And she came home with a stack of Batman. There's a orange cover. I think it's a detective issue. And it says Deadshot is back in bullets. It's a detective or a Batman issue. I don't remember the exact issue. I have since rebought it, but she brought me a bunch of Batman and then actually brought home a Moon Knight, and she didn't really understand the irony of that, but you know, I thought that was pretty funny later on. So just I've loved Batman ever since. I've never exited my Batman phase and, super glad to be on the show.
Nice. Yeah. I think that's, is that an Ed Hannigan cover with Deadshot?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good.
It's the Marshall Rogers redesign.
Yes.
But it's definitely a Hannigan cover, and you know, it's awesome.
Yeah, I know the cover you're talking about. Yeah, that's great.
I like the story, Sean, because I also started with G.I. Joe, and then Batman was the next comic that I kind of went to.
Oh, nice. Those G.I. Joe commercials worked, man. Those were a good gateway for comics. I went right to the local convenience store and picked up G.I. Joe 10, so they good marketing.
Yeah, it's really surprising that they didn't do that more. I know they did with a few of the other Hasbro lines that they did animate, but not to the level of G.I. Joe. It's kind of crazy that other comic company, DC, didn't jump on that or something. Yeah. So now, speaking of covers, we're going to cover an issue of Batman Chronicles that both Sean and Ryan are particularly passionate about. This series ran 23 quarterly issues from July/summer 1995 to winter 2001, so a pretty good run. Were you guys a fan of this series in general, Sean?
Yeah, I did pick this series up. I mean, I'm kind of a comics junkie, and I would always try, you know, and at this point, they were just throwing anything Batman-related at the wall. And I'd always try, you know, the first issue or two of something. What's funny about this series is I looked back, and I have every issue of it, but I think a good portion of this series I just picked up in quarter and dollar bins, you know, over the years. And so I do remember buying this issue off the shelf because of the unique nature of the text piece. But for the most part, this was like a dollar bin book for me. But there's some great stories. I mean, one of the best stories in this whole run is Batman talking to Barbara Gordon right after, you know, in the hospital, sort of after the killing joke. I think that for me is one of the more memorable stories in this whole run. What about you, Ryan?
I did. I really like the series. Well, I should say, I think this was probably the last issue of the series that I got, but I really liked it for like the first year. Well, it was because it was quarterly. It was several years, but yeah, I got most of the first 10 issues and I was really, really enjoying it. And then just before this issue came out, within the Batman Chronicles brand, there was a one-shot graphic novel, called Robin the Gauntlet. I think it was illustrated by Lee Weeks, and it was basically Dick Grayson as Robin out, like, for his first night on the job alone without Batman, to see how he can function. And it's just like 12 hours in the life of Robin on his first day on the job as a solo. And it was that was a really cool story. Lee Weeks' art, great. I'm saying the art was great. I'm pretty sure it was Lee Weeks, if I remember that correctly.
I think it was, yeah. And that story is so well remembered that actually the gauntlet has become a in continuity thing that every Robin has to do before they're sort of allowed to join Batman. So it's interesting because that is a great story.
Yeah, I love that. I love that comic. Yeah, that's a great one. And I think I had a subscription to this one. This was a phase where I had subscriptions to some DC comics because I was just getting tired of driving to the big city to get my comics. I think that was when I was in college and a lot of it. And it was just hard for me to get there on time. So I just started subscribing. I've got every issue, but I'm kind of like Sean. I know I've got every issue, but I went back through and looked at the covers on DC Universe Infinite, and I'm like, did I ever read that? Some of them, I'm just like, I'm not sure I ever read all those. And I know I have them, but I'm going to have to go back and look through. I did remember this one. I remember this story. I liked it. But yeah, but there are some good ones in there. The Oracle one that Sean mentioned, and of course the Gauntlet spinoff one shot, which is kind of weird that they, I guess that was just a way to say that it was in the past, you know, but it was kind of weird. But yeah, it was a good mix of all sorts of different creators coming in and out and could tell Batman stories from different periods and about different side characters. So it was nice. And I know they did another version of it a few years back as well. So the title kind of gets around.
All right. As we said, we were talking about Batman Chronicles issue 10, specifically just one story from this. But the issue had a cover date of fall 1997 and a cover price of $2.95. The issue hit the stands on August 13th that year. The cover art is by Phil Winslade and depicts, well, it's kind of hard to picture. So if you have access to it, check out our website because we will post a picture of it. But it is essentially the Gotham kind of cityscape with Batman in the corner in the foreground looking at a rooftop, and the rooftop is angled in such a way that it looks like the shape of the bat symbol, kind of upside down. Now, Sean, I have my first secret question for you.
Oh, out the gate.
Obviously, you love George Perez. He's one, you said, the greatest artist ever. And I have to ask you, do you think even George Perez could draw a cover with more individual lines than this one?
This is an insane cover. Like, it's an admirable cover because of the level of detail to the buildings. But this is a cover I look at, and I was like, and I know it's Phil Winslade, but the first time I looked at this cover, and then again to reread this issue, I didn't realize it was Winslade at first. I was like, oh, Jeff Darrow did cocaine for a while. Like that's exactly what this feels like. It's just so many lines. It is, again, an impressive feat. But I mean, even Perez would look at this and be like, hey, dude, restraint. You know, like, pull back a little, bud.
I think Marshall Rogers would say, hey, nice architecture. You know?
It, look, it's an impressive feat of a cover, but wow, it's just, it's, I don't know, it's so much. It just feels.
Yeah, I think it's something where it's almost super saturated with detail to the point where the image loses its emphasis. It loses its impact. I love the idea of this and even like the framing and everything, but it's just like, I don't know what to look at. I don't know what to focus on. It's just overwhelming.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And you really do. The eye doesn't know where to go. And then, you know, I think about great depictions of Gotham City and I think about like the Anton First, you know, that sort of Batman 89 era. And this is a really cool, you know, showing the grime of the city. I mean, this feels like pre-Giuliani Times Square, but you're right. It's too much. It's definitely, I don't know. It feels, this is going to sound really bizarre, but it feels like a plate that had a lot of spaghetti spilled on it. That's the only thing I could think of.
And is that a Volkswagen thing toward the bottom right corner, pulling away from the curb? It looks like a Volkswagen thing, you know, those.
Oh, it does. Those,
what a weird car to put in there.
That's so funny. That's really funny. When I was a 16-year-old, I wanted an M&M orange Volkswagen thing.
Yeah.
That is an awesome. Yeah, that is amazing.
I mean, who doesn't want, if you're going to have a car called the thing, you want it to be orange, right? So, yeah.
Exactly.
the one other part of the cover that we didn't mention, right underneath the title, the Batman Chronicles, which is up in the right corner, we get our little description. Featuring To See the Batman by Bob Back to the Future Gale with Bill Sienkiewicz. And that is the story that we are going to be talking about. To See the Batman. It is written by Bob Gale, illustrated by Bill Sienkiewicz, and I'll get to that, and edited by Darren Vincenzo. The illustration part of this is interesting because this is a text piece story, and that's kind of why we came to this one, because, Sean, I think on one of your podcasts, you were talking about other text piece, like Batman stories, prose Batman story. I keep saying text. Mm-hmm. I mean prose. And obviously, we have talked about it on this show however many years ago it was, Chris, but we did Death Strikes at Midnight in 3 on the last episode of Secret Origins. I did the one from the special. I did that with Tom Panarese. And Sean, you mentioned The Clown at Midnight, which was a Grant Morrison one, which is just as insane a Grant Morrison story in prose as it is in normal comic vision. But as you were talking about that, I remembered this story, and I remembered reading this when I was younger and collecting this book and still. And I know I had read Death Strikes at Midnight in 3 at that point, because I had that the trade of the greatest Batman stories ever told. But this just kind of blew me away in the format and the way it was illustrated, with like almost kind of photoreal but kind of sketchy things by Sienkiewicz, however you can describe him. And it was just such an odd story with a vision that I had never really thought about for a comic. And I will get into that now as we go through it. But the story, listeners, is narrated by Josh Posner, a 14-and-a-half-year-old who lives in a suburb just outside the Gotham City limits. He is obsessed with the hot girl, Sarah Jurgens, but he's not popular enough to be a blip on her radar. What would help his popularity, though, is if he saw Batman. One of Josh's classmates, Larry Madison, took a photo of Batman beating up some robbers in his backyard, and his rep at school shot through the roof. Josh is determined to take his own picture of Batman, which isn't as easy as the comics, TV shows, cartoons, movies, video games, and State Farm insurance commercials make it seem. He gets a cheap camera, sneaks out of the house after curfew, and takes the train into the city. He realizes, though, that he has no idea where to even begin looking for Batman and chickens out. But he's not abandoning the plan. That's how much he wants to impress Sarah Jurgens. For the next week, he becomes super mission-focused, studying maps of the city and analyzing crime patterns to find the most likely place to see the Bat. He goes back to the city, this time with a detailed bus schedule, but his only dramatic encounter is with a creepy guy at the bus stop. He tries again a few nights later and actually snaps a photo of something he thinks is Batman at first, but turns out to be laundry airing outside a window. After no luck on his third and fourth attempts, Josh decides to just lie to his classmates. He shows them the kind of blurry photo of the laundry and claims that he saw Batman beating up some thug in an alley. Larry Madison, the supposed authority on Batman, isn't convinced. The other kids say he's full of crap, until someone backs up his story. A girl named Gina Barbato, who Josh barely knows, says she was there the night Josh claims to have seen the Batman. Gina says it's all true, because Batman saved her from an attacker. Gina's story is convincing, and the two of them briefly become super popular. Josh walks her home after school, and she confesses she lied for him because she liked him. And that's enough for Josh to forget all about Sarah Jurgens. He starts dating Gina and making out with her on the roof of her apartment. All is well, except one night, someone else takes a photo of Batman and just happens to catch Josh and Gina kissing in the corner of the shot. Alrighty, Sean, big picture, what are your thoughts on this one?
I love this story. I definitely remember buying this off the racks and opening it. And getting to the Bill Sienkiewicz, I mean, I bought it for Bill Sienkiewicz. I didn't know who Bob Back to the Future Gale was at the time. And, you know, I mean, the internet wasn't really super present at the time. I couldn't look up Bob Gale. But I love Sienkiewicz. I've always loved Sienkiewicz. And so I, you know, tear the issue open. I'm going to read it. And then I get to this block of text and literally The Price is Right. They're like, bum, 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 you know, notes play in my head. Cause I'm like, oh, come on. Like, look, I'm an English major. I love prose, but you know, I love, you know, chocolate and I love salsa, but I don't want them together. And so I was a little bit of a brat about it. And then I read it and I love it. I think it's really, especially this is Bob Gale's first comic book. This is the first thing he wrote. I mean, I guess comic book in quotes, but I really love it. And I really love it for a couple of reasons. One, which, you know, I know we'll talk about the story. I love the narration. I love the voice. It's very Holden Caulfield from Catcher in the Rye. I mean, he's definitely channeling, you know, what if Holden Caulfield lived in Gotham City, which is a what if I would completely read. And then I also really love the Sienkiewicz art, you know, big picture, because it reminds me of my favorite version of Sienkiewicz, which is like Stray Toasters, Electra Assassin, just Sienkiewicz getting real weird with it. So I'm a big fan of this story and hadn't read it in a long time. And I think it really holds up.
Yeah, I really enjoy this one. I think, you know, Bob Gale obviously, you know, has a great, great handle on the teen angle, you know, because, I mean, Back to the Future, come on, you know. And I think it's, I mean, obviously this kid's a little bit younger than Marty McFly, but, you know, it the voice is great. I mean, it's as a kid that, I mean, I wasn't too far removed from Josh's age here. So I, you know, I could relate, you know, there's some things that are said in here that we'll probably have to address, but, you know, that's the way teenage kids talked to each other around that time. So, I mean, you know, I really enjoyed it. I think it does a neat job of addressing Denny O'Neill's edict that Batman was only supposed to be known as an urban myth, which I never really cared for. I just thought the DC universe at large was just contradicted that too much. I think it's kind of silly. But I think this takes that idea and runs with it and does a great job of doing something really creative with it, with that limitation, which I always kind of considered a limitation. So I think this is one of the few examples of that trope that does a great job with it and makes me go, oh, okay, well that is something worth exploring. And you know, it's just a cute, sweet story in a lot of ways, even though it's not overly sappy or sentimental, but there's just a, you know, as somebody who married their high school sweetheart, it makes me feel good about, you know, Josh and Gina's chances that maybe they made it, you know, I don't know. Maybe they stuck together. I hope they did. So,
yeah, one of my first things reading on the reread this in preparation for this, like thinking about the whole, you know, Josh is obsessed with a hot girl, Sarah, but he finds out it's this other girl who doesn't present herself as the prom queen, head of the cheerleaders and everything, but she's the one who's really the cool one, really probably closer to his soulmate, at least in terms of where he is as a teenager. And I kept on thinking of the parallel with Spider-Man Homecoming, with Peter being obsessed with Liz in the story, and it turns out it's MJ that he should be with, that he finally discovers at the end. I was just maybe a year or two older than him when I read this story the first time. So it spoke me as he's talking about Nintendo 64. He name drops Pamela Anderson Lee, not just Pamela Anderson, but when she was married to Tommy Lee in this one. That was important. That was a big deal. Yeah, it was just, I didn't know you could tell a story like this, which was a story that approached a fantastical superhero world in such a grounded, realistic way that it's a story in Batman's world that's not about Batman. He lingers large over it, but it's also, it's one of those stories where this story is tangential to the action. It's close to the real. It's like you can reach your arm out at what the cool thing is, but you're just really kind of removed because of who you are and your circumstances. This kid, like, when I was reading this the first time, I was like, he's going to become Robin at the end of this, right? I mean, that's why he's studying the maps and becoming an expert of all these, like, tactical plans and everything. I was like, he's training for something, right? I was like, no, that's not the thing. He's just a kid. So, like, I in high school, like, I think maybe partly inspired by this, in high school, I actually wrote a story that was kind of close to the Titanic, but didn't have anything to do with the Titanic sinking. It was something like somebody who tried to sink the Titanic, but failed, but ultimately it sank anyway. So there was like this ironic thing, but I think I was like, I want to tell a story that's kind of like close to the major event, but really doesn't impact it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I always thought this was a real fun one.
That's awesome, though. That is, I'd like to read your Titanic story because that sounds really funny. Yeah.
I doubt it still exists, but it was only, I think it was only 3 pages, but yeah, it wasn't well written. As for the creative team, like, again, like Bob, Back to the Future, Gale, this is the second thing of his I think I've recorded about, because Bob Gale wrote Ant-Man's Big Christmas, which many years ago I covered on an episode of Find Your Joy with FW Presents. And the artist on that was Phil Winslade, the guy who drew the cover of this issue. The interiors of Ant-Man's Big Christmas was nowhere near as detailed as that cover. It was really good.
Well, this is so I listened to an interview with Bob Gale, and this is his first comic book. And he, you know, I guess over the years, you know, co-writing all those Back to the Futures with Robert Zemeckis. And actually, I think we bury the lead calling him Bob Back to the Future Gale. I'd call him Bob Used Cars Gale because I love that movie. I don't know. It might be before your time, Ryan. It's a Kurt Russell classic.
Yep.
But I love that movie. It's just Kurt Russell is smarmiest and charmingest. And it's just it's a fun movie. But I you know, watched this interview with him, and he was saying that, you know, he would always talk in interviews about how much he loved comics. And actually, he has letters in Iron Man 2 and 3.
Wow.
All the way back in the 60s.
Wow.
He's like, yeah, if you go back into those. Yeah. And he's like, you go back. And I think he said his first letter was like Tales of Suspense 98. So he's like, you know, you go back and look at these letters. He's like, I'm in there as a young man. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah, he was also during the Brand New Day era of Spider-Man comics, which everybody loved. he was part of, like, they had their, because when they were doing Amazing Spider-Man weekly, or 3 times a month at least, they had their rotating creative teams in order to keep it. And he was one of the 4 on that rotating team. He was one of the main writers of that first year or two.
I remember that vividly because Dan Slott clearly separated himself as the best of that bunch. But Gale's stories were fun, where some of the other writers were going real heavy, and I'm like, that's not really Spider-Man. I mean, Spider-Man has dark moments, but, like, you know, there should be some fun. Gale was clearly just having a lot of fun with it. But, you know, and then he wrote this story, and then they asked him to do the opening chapter of No Man's Land a couple years later, that big Batman year-long arc. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he was kind of getting into comics at this time, but it is funny because he, one of the things he said about this story that resonated was when they asked him to write this story, he had just read Marvels by Alex Ross and Kurt Busiek, and he wanted a, like, window into the DC universe kind of story. So I was like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So this is kind of his version of Marvels. But again, clearly the man is a fan of Catcher in the Rye, because this kid, Josh Posner, even his name, you know, sounding like Poser, it's just a modern, you know, it's totally a modern Holden Caulfield, and it, for good and for ill. I mean, Josh is kind of a sad sack and annoying in the beginning, and then doesn't realize that as soon as he gets a goal, he gets smart and interesting and focused. And I love those little moments where he's like, even my grades are improving. And it's like, well, yeah, dumbass, you're focusing. You're not just, you know, sitting around staring at Sarah Jurgensen or whatever. You know, it's really funny. So I just think it really is a well-crafted, you know, character piece, and good for Gale. I mean, obviously the man's talented, but for coming out of the chute was something this interesting.
And for being at times very of the time, like I said, like right at the beginning, he's mentioning Nintendo 64, Pamela Anderson, stuff like that. So he's definitely trying to hook a contemporary audience, but there is definitely a timelessness quality to this story that I think really helps it stick around.
Mm-hmm.
With the notable exception of something you couldn't do today, really. Sure, he got some pushback about doing it then, but listeners, well, one of the F words is used in this story.
Yep.
The homosexual slur F word is used in the story, which kind of like leaps out today when you look at it, you're like, oh, hey, they did that. I mean, it's used in context. It's a teenager, the way kids talk to each other. But it's also like, it's surprising for that, 1997.
Yeah, this was, I think the comics code's nowhere on this, so, we were past that by now, so yeah, but it is shocking. No, it's on the cover, approved by the Comics Code Authority, I just looked. So, just goes to show you how much teeth they had left by the time this came out.
Oh yeah, they'd worn him down by now. It is funny. It's funny to look back at art from different time periods as kind of an artifact. Like I don't know, Ryan, if you've had this happen with your son, but I tried to show my daughter the original Peter Pan, the Disney Peter Pan,
mm-hmm.
when she was homesick one day when she was like 4, and I was home with her. And I was like, hey, you know, let's get out of the house. She'd been home like that whole week. And so I'm like, let's get out of the house. We go to Target. We're just walking around Target aimlessly, which is probably the only way to walk around Target. And I see Peter Pan. I see it's on sale for like $5. I grab it. We go home to watch it. And I mean, we're like 10 minutes in and I'm like, nope. I'm like, I forgot how crazy racist and sexist this movie is. I'm like, clearly different set of standards. And my poor daughter's like, Dad, why are you turning it off? And I'm like, nope. Not going to do it. I'm like, I'll explain it to you when you're older. But it is funny to see, you know, we just don't see a word like that. And then even, and I'm not complaining because I think this is a great story and I think people should read it. But even the way we meet Gina, Josh has snapped the laundry picture of Batman, which is really funny. And he's trying to pass it off at school as a picture of Batman. And he's showing it to the kid who actually got a picture of Batman to verify as if this kid's some sort of expert, which is really funny. And the kid's like, I don't know, maybe, maybe not. And she walks in and she's like, no, that's definitely it. I was there. These guys tried to like accost me. And I was like, oh, I'm like, that's another thing you wouldn't see in 2026 is, you know, like a teenager in a situation like that being used as a fake story, as a story point. So that part I was like, and I'm not overly hung up on it because it's a good story, but. And I like that she kind of comes in off the top rope to rescue him. And I just love her name too, because don't you feel like he was listening to Bon Jovi? I mean, she, you know, like, I don't know, can you name a female character Gina and not have it come from a Bon Jovi song?
There you go. Well, they are in New Jersey. It's Gotham. You
exactly.
Know? So, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, just across the river from Metropolis, right? Isn't that?
Right, right.
I showed my son the original Peter Pan just a couple of months ago. Luckily, he was kind of zoning out and doing something on the iPad during the Tiger Lily, her tribe, doing their song thing. And I was like, I don't pay attention to this one.
Yeah.
But of course, because my son is kind of a monster, his whole thing is he thinks Peter Pan is the villain because he cut Captain Hook's hand off for no reason and threw it to an alligator. How horrible is that?
Well, I mean, pretty fair.
I was like, Captain Hook is the evil pirate. He's the bad guy. He's like, what does he do that's so evil? And I'm like, pirate stuff?
Yeah. He's like, pirates are awesome. You don't cut a person's hand off. Like, that's a little, you know, that's draconian, man. It's like, just because he, you know, stole some booty doesn't mean you disarm the guy. That is funny, though, that he sympathized with. That is another, you know, thing I see in my kid, too, where we will try to go back and watch. Like I showed her Ace Ventura. And she did not even crack. She's like, this guy's just mean. This is mean. This is, and I'm like, come on. I'm like, even the butt scene in the police department. She's like, I don't know. It's kind of childish. And I'm like, yeah, that's the point. I'm like, come on, man. Give me something here. It's tough.
That reminds me of my daughter in the second Creature from the Black Lagoon movie where they capture him and take him to basically SeaWorld. And she just got up and walked out of the room. She's like, no, no, I'm not watching this. And she just got up and walked out. And I mean, that she was like 7 or 8 and we were watching that. And I'm like, wow, well, I don't disagree with her. It's like, yeah, he should take all these people out, you know,
that's awesome.
Captured him and put him on display. But yeah, and she told, we told Riku Browning that played the creature that when we met him at a convention and he loved it. Yeah. So yeah.
That is awesome. Well, I have a secret question for you guys. I felt obligated to bring one with me to you know, maintain my rep, I guess, which is weird. So I love Sienkiewicz's art in this and using him as you said, like as a series of photographs to tell the story. And so it makes total sense given his art style. So my question for you is, if not Sienkiewicz, who do you think would be another really effective artist to help augment a story through a series of photographs, basically to augment a text piece? Who would be another choice for you?
Can I go first?
Yeah.
Off the top of my head, I'm going to cheat because you already mentioned Marvel's Alex Ross.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you don't get more photorealistic than Alex Ross, right? So, yeah, I think he'd be perfect. I could mention a few others, but I don't want to take them all from Ryan. So I'll say Alex Ross.
I was kind of comparing the art in this one to Dave McKean a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
But also, and maybe I'm thinking about it just because the book is right next to me, the Batman graphic novel Night Cries was illustrated by Scott Hampton.
Oh.
And I could see Scott Hampton like having like his style doing the story. And that's among my very favorite Batman stories ever told, which maybe someday we'll cover on the show.
I think, is this by the time Gene Ha went to that photorealistic style?
Yeah.
He'd be good as well.
That's a great pull, Chris. Yeah, from like top 10.
Yeah. Yeah. And when he did that, he did the Black Canary Starman when they had their affair in the Starman annual. He did that segment. Yeah. So, yeah.
Top 10, man. I think back to, I love that whole ABC line. I love Tom Strong. But top 10, given how few issues it is still, I think, one of the best series in the 90s. It was just, Moore and Ha. I mean, that was a great team. But, you know, I think one of the other artists I think of, because I don't actually like him doing sequential art, is, do you guys remember Simone Bianchi?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, an Italian artist in like the early 2000s. He did like a lot of Wolverine. He did the Silent Night. Or the miniseries, not Silent Night, who's Sir Justin from All-Star Squadron?
Shining Knight.
He did the Shining Knight miniseries for the Seven Soldiers Grant Morrison project. And Bianchi is like a fine art illustrator. Like his stuff is beautiful. It should be in ad campaigns and everything. But he really didn't have, at the time, especially storytelling chops. Like it was hard to get like, to look at an issue he drew and not just see it as a series of still images, but his still images were better than almost anybody else's. So I think he'd be amazing. And I thought about Dave McKean too, Ryan. I thought about the Black Orchid miniseries. Mm-hmm. There are moments in here that remind me a lot of images from that.
Yeah. Yeah. And Simon Bianchi did a lot of detective covers, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I remember there's particularly one where Bruce is sitting in a chair in the Batcave with his cowl off and it's a really cool image. Yeah, that's just the one that popped in my head.
Yeah, during like the Paul Dini run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I mean, Sienkiewicz was such a smart choice. I mean, the images, do you have a favorite image?
Probably the very last page, which, and it's one like to mention, like every little one is really good. I mean, even like there's just the shots of Gina are good. But yeah, the very last page, like I thought that was so clever because the way the story kind of unfolds, he's talking about, well, his last paragraph as he's narrating it is, some nights we sit on the roof of her building. It's six stories up and we look out at the moon and the Gotham skyline and we talk and we laugh and we it's great. Except for this one night when some jerk took our picture, and then we get a little clipping from the Westvale Courier reprinted. It's like residents of the Stanton Street apartments who were up late Tuesday night and happened to be looking east would have seen what Stan Rosen captured with his camera from the building roof. You turn to the next page. It's a full kind of full page splash picture of Batman kind of on the roof of like a bridge, like overhead, like the Gotham City Bridge or something like that, just leaning, and his very stylized bat silhouette is over the moon, and that's kind of where you're looking. And then if your eye just drifts to the bottom left corner, very out of focus, you see this couple making out or possibly going further. but I love the composition. I love the cleverness of the way that's used, but even the picture of the laundry, because where you can, when you focus on it, it's like, okay, it's a shirt and it's just held up by these clotheslines, but the way the light is hitting, the clothesline, that V shape is what's creating the image of the bat ears on the wall that makes you think it's Batman. So he was so good.
That laundry Batman silhouette looks like Dave McKean from Arkham Asylum.
Yeah.
I think he's definitely evoking that.
I feel like Dave McKean kind of did kind of lift Sienkiewicz's Batman from like Batman 400,
mm-hmm.
You know, because like the cover of Batman 400 and then the segment he drew of that, is which we covered like on Nightcast episode one, I think.
Yeah.
That. But yeah, I like the image of Josh where he's casting Batman's shadow with a Batman t-shirt. I think that's really, that's really cool. I feel like if that could have been a, if this had been the cover, and maybe this should have been the cover, maybe this should have been the cover of the issue right here. Cause I feel like, you know, and it's like you could put To See the Batman by Bob, Back to the Future, Gale, and Bill Sienkiewicz. And I think might have sold a little few more comics. I don't know. I like that the Phil Winslade cover's fine, but you know, don't bury the lead here. You know, this is what you, this is what you came for. But yeah, going back to the image, Ryan, talked about the final image. I've got it in my notes. Are they naked? I mean, I know they're 14 and a half. I don't want to get creepy here at all, but it's like, maybe he's got a shirt on. He kind of looks like he's got maybe the a t-shirt sleeve, but other than that, she looks like she might be naked. And I'm just like, oh, wow, okay, yeah. And, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, that's a little, again, something that's a little, I don't know about today. You'd see that about kids that young in a story, but... yeah, they might not be, but I don't know. So
I think it's more, you know, this is, I don't know. You're right. It does. I mean, you can kind of see a shirt sleeve on him. You're right. And if you look real close, it does look like maybe she's not wearing stuff, but you know, I choose to believe it's maybe just like a crop top or something. But I think the, you know, kind of, I don't know, artistically, metaphorically, it's like the purity of this young love, you know, like they're in the white photo negative in a way.
Yeah.
And then contrasted right up the diagonally to the darkness of Batman against the white of the moon. And it's kind of a neat thing, right? Cause this, the whole story, this kid is dumb. I mean, he's just every 14-year-old boy is dumb. Every 40-year-old boy is dumb. You know, we're just dumb. We're dumb creatures, but every 14-year-old boy in particular is dumb. And his whole plan is so, I mean, he does it in a smart way over the course of the story, but the plan itself is ridiculous. Like, oh, hey, I'm going to go put myself in real danger in order to try to spot this potentially mythical creature, in order to try to capture your photo, in order to maybe capture the heart of a girl who doesn't even know I exist. Like, it's, you know, it's again, 14-year-old boy logic, but I like the idea of like, he dipped his toe into Batman's world and the world is dark, but he got pulled out of it before it tainted him. And he got pulled out of it. And this is, I mean, you guys can throw things at me through the computer here. He got pulled out of it by love, you know, like by, you know, by innocence, by the sweetness of young love. And, and so I kind of like that contrast. And so I really saw it more as an experiment in shading and in color. But yeah, it does kind of look that way. So I love that image too. And I really love the two of Gina because the first time you see her, Sienkiewicz draws her with an edge. You know, she looks like a tough kid. She looks like a tough, you know, and she's telling this dark story. Thankfully it's false, but she's telling this dark story of being accosted in an alley and Josh taking this photo and it kind of inadvertently helping save her. And then when you cut forward and he's starting to fall for her, there's this great photo of her hair falling in front of her face and she's sort of smiling gently. And I thought that was really a cool way to depict, you know, when we start developing feelings for people, the way we see them changes dramatically. And just, you know, huge shout out to Sienkiewicz for being one of the great artists of all time.
The picture that you mentioned with Josh kind of standing up against the wall, casting the shadow of Batman off him. I think you're right. Like that could have been the cover, or a variation of this idea could have been the cover, perhaps should have been. But I can also see that being an author photo for like Denny O'Neill or maybe Neil Adams, somebody who's like historically canonically like connected to Batman and like kind of known for their work on that. Like this could be like a Denny O'Neill like profile picture in a magazine or something, or Neil Adams or somebody else like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You put a question mark on his shirt and it would have been a great ad for the Batman. I mean, he looks like Paul Dano. I mean, honestly, it really would have been. You put a question mark on that shirt and it's like, man, I want to see this movie.
True.
Sean, I like what you were saying. And I mean, obviously when I was reading this, I didn't have the vocabulary. I didn't have the kind of education to think about it this way. But upon a reread, I really like, this is a quest story.
Oh, yeah.
It's Josh's quest. And a quest narrative structurally has certain beats. And from everything from Sir Gawain and the Green Knight up to the Indiana Jones movies, it's the quest is looking for something, this attainable object that they want. Ultimately, that's not what the quest is about. The quest is about getting knowledge. Mm-hmm. Self-knowledge. But like, it's pointed out in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade when he asks his dad, "What did you get?" And he says, "Illumination, son." And it's the connection of what they realized about their connection as father and son. And it's this one. It's he wanted Batman because he wanted Gina, and he wanted to be bigger. He wanted to be popular. He wanted all these things, and he was willing to go out into the big city and meet the monsters of this unhoused guy or homeless guy who's creeping up on him at the bus stop. And he's like running into the dark alleys, and he wants to expose himself to this danger. But at the end, when he could get the thing that he thinks he wanted, what he really wanted was this girl who likes him already, and he falls in love with her, and that's what he kind of comes away with this learning. So I love the epiphany and the realization of what he thought he wanted wasn't really what the story was ultimately leading towards.
That's an awesome analysis, because the other piece of that is what he was looking for was external validation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was attaching himself to not only Batman, but to this Larry kid who had captured a picture and gained popularity. And he was basically just following what this kid Forrest Gumped his way into. And it's that external validation is hollow. And then he gets, and this is the thing I really loved about this story, is when Gina enters the picture towards the end, she tells this fake story to back Josh up on the photo. But more importantly, Josh sees her like kind of walking, and he goes over to walk home with her. And she says, "Hey, I wanted to talk to you before this." He's like, "Why'd you do that? Why'd you cover for me?" And she's like, "I saw you." There's at one point he mentions they're building these like basically like a new freeway. And before the freeway is in use for cars, he gets on his bike and rides his bike on it because it's really cool basically to get to ride your bike on an empty freeway, which is a very 14-year-old boy thing. And she says to him, "I saw you riding your bike on the empty freeway. I was doing something similar. And I thought that was really cool. I thought you get it. Like, this is a fun thing to do." And all of a sudden he gets validation for something that was in him, not something that was external. And then, yeah, you get that very sweet picture at the end. Chris, I love that you tied it to you and Cindy. It made it even sweeter, the high school sweetheart piece. I mean, just made it even sweeter. I mean, not all of us lucked out enough to date a Cindy in high school. Some of us, you know, some of us dated evil stepsisters in high school. And, you know, so, you know, fortunately, all we have are photos from then. But definitely, it's such a sweet moment, and it's so well constructed. You're right, like a quest narrative is. And man, kudos to Gale, because for what was just a little writing experiment in a medium he hadn't necessarily done before is pretty damn impressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like the little bits he throws in at the end of how Larry doesn't like Batman because his rabbits were set free. He had pet rabbits, and they were set free during the robbery, and they got, some of them died, and he misses his rabbits. And then his parents have gotten sued by the criminals because Batman's not, you know, he can't testify in court. And like, it mentions that Bruce Wayne has picked up, like hired him a lawyer who he comes in and does, which is like, if Bruce does that too much, that's obviously going to point back to him. But I like that world building too. That again, that adds to that layer of, these are characters that exist in this universe that are, you know, tangential to all the big stories, but that it's still everything that happens affects them. And I think that's a great way to look at it and a great way to examine it and kind of broaden this world, especially within, like I said, this period when nobody's supposed to know Batman even exists, which I do question. He does know Two-Face, and he has his coin, and his gimmick of flipping his coin, because he does it himself and mentions it. So it's like, if they know Two-Face is real and flips his coin, why is Batman so hard to believe or verify? But that bugaboo is a, you know, but yeah, Gale did wonderful things with the structure he was given. And I'll give him credit. He wrote a story within the universe, and we've seen a lot of outside writers, you know, big authors that come in from other media, from film, from novels, when they come in, they want to, you know, they want to break the toys. They want to, you know, Gail doesn't do that here. It's totally within the Batman universe of the time. It's this story totally fits within that.
Yeah, and he clearly loves his character, this Josh kid he creates, because he doesn't let, pardon the pun, while the shadow of the bat weighs over this whole story, it's Josh's story. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, Batman doesn't technically appear in it at all. I mean, that picture at the end, you know, if you really look at it, kind of looks like a dragon taking off into the sky. But you know, Batman, you know, isn't really present, and yet he's present in every page and in every word. And I actually kind of wish somebody, I don't know, did you guys feel like Josh would have been a fun secondary character in like the Tim Drake Robin series? Like I almost wish somebody would have read this and picked up on him and had him become a friend of like Tim Drake's.
Yeah, that would be cool. Cause I mean, he had a good supporting cast. Tim yeah. did mm-hmm. in the Chuck Dixon era. So yeah, it would have been fun especially when he went to that school, his dad sent him to the private school.
That's what I was thinking too. Yeah.
Yeah. That would have been kind of cool. Yeah.
I did like the end when, like, the little switch where he becomes friends with Larry and they bond and he finds out that Larry doesn't even like Batman. He's mad at Batman. And because his dad hates Batman because of being sued and everything. I didn't like his final turn against Sarah. Where she's like, well, yeah, she smokes a lot. She's got bad teeth, bad breath, or something like that. So it's like, she's not that hot after all. And it's like, all right, I get kind of the 14-year-old thinking that, but I kind of wish, like, yeah. I don't think we had to give her any defect or take anything away from her for Josh to still say, no, Gina is the one I love. She's more special. I see something in her of myself that, you know, Sarah's like super attractive, super hot, but that's not what I'm looking for. And I didn't think like, I think it's much more easier to say, oh yeah, I'll go with Gina because the other one isn't that great. And it's, I don't know. I didn't necessarily like that change.
Yeah, I didn't either. But I mean, it rang true because, again, just dumb. Yeah. You know, 14-year-old. As somebody who taught freshmen and sophomores for years, the male brain at that age is just a thing of wonder. I mean, and this is actually weirdly the other thing I want to give Gail huge credit for. Is this is a quest, you know, as you said, Ryan, this is a quest narrative, and you know, there is some real literary quality to this story, and it's definitely evoking, you know, Catcher in the Rye and other, you know, sort of coming of age novels. But at the same time, the answer to Larry's problems was girl. You know, basically,
to Josh's problem.
He was a Yeah, or Josh's, sorry. It was Josh's problem, it was girl. You know, he was a horny teenager and he, you know, was lacking focus and was latching onto this urban legend. And it turned out at the end of the day, what he needed was some female attention. And I just think that's really funny. It reminds me of one of my favorite moments in a not great comic is there was this all new X-Men book in the early 2000s. Christopher Yost and Craig Kyle wrote it, the guys who wrote X-Men Evolution, uh-huh. and Mark Brooks penciled it. And it was kind of like an X-23 showcase book. But anyway, it was about the young kids at the Xavier Institute. And these guys, these authors come in and they take the book really dark and they have there's this M-Day event. The mutants lose their powers and a bunch of the kids lose their powers and the X-Men put them on a bus to send them home to keep them safe. And like the pure fires or whatever blow up the bus. I mean, literally they kill like 40 kids. It's just a crazy dark comic. And I remember being really turned off by this when I read it. But there's this funny moment where one of the kids who has his powers and survives is really depressed about all his friends dying. And the teachers like Kitty Pryde and Emma Frost and Scott Summers are all trying to figure out what to do because they're worried about this kid's mental health. And they're like, how do you snap a teenage boy out of depression? And they cut to the boy in his room alone in the dark. And a female student comes in and goes, hey, I'm really sad. And he's like, yeah, me too. She's like, do you want to make out? And he's like, yeah. And then I think that was it. Like that was the answer to his depression. And so I just kind of love that idea of like, you know, it's sometimes we're simple creatures, you know, and I think it's a cute, one of the cute things that comes out of this story is, you know, what he really needed was, you know, some attention, and it's cute.
Anything else for to see the Batman?
I just have a quick question for you guys, not like a secret question, but you know, this is definitely not the only story that does a citizen's eye view of heroes or Gotham in particular. Do you guys have a favorite or a that style of story you would recommend? I know we talked about Marvels. Yeah. That's definitely one. I don't know if you guys ever read the Gotham Knights miniseries from the late 80s. It was John Ostrander and Mary Mitchell. And it's like a 4 or 6 issue mini. And I just remember it because it's basically from the point of view of the citizens of Gotham. Like, I think the first issue opens with the couple on a date, and it's his first date since his wife died, and she died in a Joker gas attack. Like, I remember being really like, oh God, that would happen a lot over there. So, it doesn't have to be Batman, but any kind of slice of life comics that you guys think are great.
I'm trying to think.
Sorry, I sprung that on you.
No, it's okay. Yeah.
This would be the first thing I think of when I asked that question. So now I'm trying to think of something else.
I don't know. I think it's not really – I think about that story in the Christmas with the Superheroes #2 where guy's stuck on the highway and he's freezing and he's got some kind of terminal disease anyway and he's going to kill himself. And Superman just pops up beside him and he talks to Superman. It's by Paul Chadwick from Concrete. Mm-hmm. And basically Superman comes in, warms him up with his heat vision and kind of talks him down. And he gives him the directions to the Kent's house. He says, I got a lot of friends across the country. These people will put you up and give you a good meal and you don't have to spend Christmas alone. I know that's kind of Superman's more involved than, but at first he's not. He doesn't show up till like several pages in. And heartstring puller, and it's just a really that whole comic's great. That's just a great comic.
Oh yeah, isn't that the one with the Kara dead man story?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. And then Chris, isn't there a Starman issue like that? I remember a Christmas issue of Starman.
Yep. Yeah, Shag just recently covered it on Justice Society Presents, and Cindy and I covered it at one point too on a Superman's Christmas special. But yeah, it's the whole, the O'Dares and the whole family, like bringing this guy that was basically a homeless guy dressed as Santa Claus and Jack helps him, at Christmas time and he comes and spends, Christmas with the whole cast of the comic. So yeah, it's a really sweet story. Yeah.
That's awesome. The other thing I would recommend, kind of selfishly, cause I did do a podcast about it years ago, is Astro City by Kurt Busiek and Brent Anderson, where a number of the issues in that book, especially the book was published, he did a 6-issue mini and then they did a full series relaunch at Image. And the first issue of the Image relaunch, so the first issue of volume 2, is about like a single dad who moves to the city with his 2 daughters after his wife passes, and he moves to Astro City and like experiences his first basically like Galactus attack, but you don't actually, it has nothing to do with the heroes. It has nothing to do with that. It's all about the neighbors and how the neighbors in his building have this entire system of like, after a superhero attack, we all come down and clean. We do a big potluck. We do a street party. And he like finds this community he's been looking for all along. So I'd recommend Astro City for a million reasons, but in particular, if you ever want a good slice of life comic, that's a great one.
Wasn't there an Astro City where like a guy's wife was like blipping out of continuity because of like a crisis like event or something? There was like his continuity changed or something and he noticed it. Or I remember there was something like that. I remember reading that once and like being like, oh my God, that's what would happen. Like that's not. That's like the Huntress and Earth 2 Robin going in Crisis 11. Like, we don't have a world. My parents don't exist. Dick Grayson's only a 19-year-old. But it's like happening to real people. You know, I can't remember. I just remember that. I think it was in Astro City. Am I crazy?
It was. Yeah. It's Astro City 1/2, actually. It's the Wizard special issue.
Oh, okay.
I think it's one of the best single issue comics of all time because the guy keeps having dreams of this woman. And he loves her and he knows he loves her, but he can't remember her. And then he meets the Hanged Man, who's like the specter of the Astro City universe. And the Hanged Man comes to him and says, look, there was this crisis. She was erased from time, but your love was strong enough that you still have this like imprint of her. And he offers the guy, do you want to forget? And the guy says, no. And then the guy says to him, wait, am I the only person this has happened to? And the Hanged Man says, no. And he goes, does anybody ever choose to forget? And the Hangman says, no. It's just, I mean, just a like man, Busick.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Such a great, it's a great story.
I know I have that. I got to go dig it out and and read it after we do this.
I mean, just a pull on the heartstrings, you know, story. It's amazing.
Okay. I thought of two while you guys were talking. One of them is an actual, it's a prose story. It's not a comic. It was in the anthology book, The Further Adventures of Batman. There's a story called Neutral Ground, which is about a guy in Gotham City who makes the costumes for Batman, the Riddler, and other characters and stuff like that.
Yes.
I like that story. And then another one, Chris, I'm not sure if you've read this one, but Sean, you'll know this one. Pizza is My Business.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The Hawkeye issue told from the perspective of Pizza Dog.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
That's such a great issue from just an amazing comic. That's awesome. That's a great choices, right?
All right. Anything else before we let Sean go?
No, just thank you guys so much for having me on the episode. I loved it. It's a great story. It's a great story to revisit. It's on for people who are listening. It's on DC, you know, it's online and can be found very readily. And just thanks to guys. I mean, you know, I told you guys before, I love the show and super happy to be a guest today.
Well, we're glad you stopped by. We had a great time talking to you about it. This is a great story, and we had a great discussion. You, of course, you always up the level of the literary examination too, Sean, so we appreciate it.
Yeah, but I also bring it down with stories about underoos, Chris, so I'm not a you know, for every high, there's a low.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick promo break. After that, at least two of us will be back with listener feedback from the last four episodes. Stick around.
In 1987, a legend was reborn when George Perez and DC Comics recreated and relaunched Wonder Woman, helping bring some truth and understanding to the newly formed post-crisis DC universe. Between the bullets, the bracelets, angry gods, a new city, and a new supporting cast, Wonder Woman rejoined the never-ending battle for a more loving and peaceful way of life. Join me, Sean, and a bevy of all-star podcast guests on Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast, where we review each issue of the George Perez written and drawn Wonder Woman series and try to bring some peace to man's world each month. So find a little bit of paradise only on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. What's so funny about this love and understanding? Oh,
what's so funny about this love and understanding? Across the DC multiverse, countless worlds exist in parallel, each with its own history, its own heroes, its own destiny. I'm DC Dave, and this is Infinite Earths, a guide to the DC multiverse, a travel log and field guide to the worlds beyond the familiar. Each episode, we chart a different Earth, exploring its origins, its defining stories, and the cosmic architecture that shaped it. From the earliest multiverse experiments to the mythic forces that rewrote reality itself, every world has a place on the map. The Orrery is waiting. Join me. Let's explore.
Okay, we're back, and now we're going to cover feedback from the last four episodes, starting with episode 47, where we covered Legends of the Dark Knight, number 79, the Christmas episode. We heard from Andrew Leyland from Hey Kids Comics in the Overlooked Dark Knight, who said, I listen every month and would write in more, but there doesn't seem any point, as Chris says everything I would say normally at this exact same time I'd say it. It's uncanny. This time it was the Robin artist question, where he said the exact same names I said at pretty much the exact same time. It's like he's Darren Brown or some such. Anyway, favorite Batmobile is the 60s one and the muscle car. A great Dick Grayson Robin artist you didn't mention is Scott McDaniel. Yeah, of course. Yeah, Scott McDaniel. But yeah, me and Andy tend to like share a brain, apparently. It's really weird. We're like, you know, we're like the brothers from another mother or something. It's really weird.
We got a comment from Benjamin Sherman, who said, I'm always so happy when you guys drop a new episode. You are two of the best, smartest, and funniest comics podcasters around, whether on your own together. Listeners, I swear this is what the comment said. I'm not just making this up. Benjamin also said, and greetings to Captain Entropy, who I'm pretty sure I know how he is just from hearing his voice. Yeah, and Captain Entropy was a great guest on our Christmas episode. The audio quality of our recording was a lot worse on the audio file than it was when we were actually recording it. I didn't realize that, but when I listened back, I was like, this sounds worse than when we were actually talking to each other. And unfortunately, we couldn't redo it because of circumstances. He was traveling, but we had a blast talking to him. I wish it sounded better, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was unfortunate that it didn't sound as good, but we did have a good time. And I'm glad that Benjamin's check cleared, that our check cleared to Benjamin,
He said smartest and funniest. He didn't say sexiest. I think that was a prerequisite.
Next time work on that, Benjamin, okay? No, it's just like, Tim Price from The Outcaster said, you've all had me thinking too much about how the chessmen broke into Wayne Manor. The main thought I had is Bruce depends too much on private alarms to protect the Batcave, and none of the alarms go straight to the police because the last thing he wants is cops poking around the manor and messing with clock faces or busts of Shakespeare or the like. But he underprotects the manor itself since it's a less critical target, relying on the Wayne reputation and the manor's isolation, plus his own secrecy means intel on valuables in the manor is scarce, making it high risk for little return. So Bruce underestimated how stupid the superstitious and cowardly lot could also be. Add on the burglary happening when Bruce and Alfred are distracted, and it could just work. Barely. Still, it was an interesting mental exercise to consider. Thanks for the great show. Merry Christmas, guys. Well, I hope you had a Merry Christmas as well there, Tim, and thank you for your comment. And yes, we probably all thought too much about how they broke in. So,
Bucky749 said, imagine you're a comic book writer and DC's Batman editor has called and said that they are going to give you a trial run. You get 5 issues of Batman Family to run as you want. And you get to launch a new villain 6-issue miniseries of your choice, and your big break for the next 3 months, you're writing the main story in Detective Comics. So what will you do? Well, before I get into mine, Captain Entropy actually answered this question at great length. I'm not going to read it all, but listeners, if you check out our comments section for this episode, the Cap gave a whole spiel about like a new Batman storyline with new villains and a crazy world. And it's a really cool, really cool story that would be fun if that ever got done. For me, I don't really typically care for villain centric miniseries. Sometimes they're good, but if I had to do one, I would probably make it star Louis the Lilac. I think that would be, my villain of choice. I would make him a big deal. And actually just because
Uncle
of the
Milty.
Because of the flower connection, I would have Black Canary be a foil in one of the issues. Yeah.
Yeah, you could, and of course Poison Ivy could appear, because he kind of was the weird stand-in for Poison Ivy in Batman 66 with the whole floral, thing going on. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I don't know. If I got to run Batman Family, I think it would be fun to just, if you had like a 5 issues, just to do like a retro kind of, like in modern continuity, like the kind of, like, a Bat Robin and Batgirl team up and a Man-Bat story and just throw in some random, Alfred and Commissioner Gordon, like by modern creators, just by, like take the Batman Family template that, Paul and Sean, the comic that they covered on Batman Family Reunion, but do it in modern times with modern creators. I think that'd be kind of fun. As far as a villain miniseries, I'm with you. I'm not real big on doing that with villains. I want to jokingly say Condiment King or something, but no, I don't know. I'd kind of like to do, and I think this is partially because of the discussion, Ryan, that you guys had, you and Paul and Max had on, Sandman Mystery Theater, the Sandman Slip Here segment of, Justice Society Presents recently, but, a miniseries about set in the pre-crisis continuity about Killer Croc, about his backstory. That would be cool. Like the original Killer Croc, who was just a kid with a skin disease that became a circus strongman and then a gangster. I want to hear, and maybe bring Jerry Conway back and let him write it. You know, well, I'm supposed to write it, but maybe I'd co-plot it with Jerry Conway, you know, so I think that'd be cool. And if I wrote Batman Family, that, and Detective Comics, I think what I'd do after that is take a vacation because I'd be exhausted. So, you know.
I've got several ideas for a story for Detective Comics, but I'm not giving those away for free. So, sorry, Bucky. I'm not telling you those.
That's right. Yeah. They're not going to give away those mystery stories away for free. Yeah, because if I was going to write Detective Comics, I think I'd try to take it to the let's make it a detective story type, you know, versus a Batman superhero story. Yeah. Speaking of Paul Keen, he from DC Special Cast and your Sandman Slept Here series, he said, favorite Batmobile 70 sports car, but I'm surprised no one has mentioned the Breyfogle version, which I always thought was cool. Ah, Carmine Infantino, Spider-Woman. Didn't like his art at the time, but there was ... about the way he drew Jessica. Enough said. I opted not to re-listen to the part where Chris was comparing spoiler to Cindy. Sounds a little too kinky. I don't remember what I said. I don't remember what I said, but okay. But yeah, sorry if I offended. He might have got flustered by this episode. I'm sorry. You know, I keep relating things to me and Cindy. Sorry. Yeah, that's the Breyfogle Batmobile. He had like at least two distinct ones he drew, but you know, and I've actually got the when Corgi was doing those die casts. Cars about, well, it's almost been probably 25 years ago now, of the different comic styles. I've got the little, you know, the 1/43rd scale of those two Breyfogle cars, and they're really cool. So, yeah, he designed a great Batmobile. Very distinct.
I think I've been thinking about this more after getting this question. My favorite might be the way Brian Boland drew it in The Killing Joke. Mm. Very reminiscent of the 40s one, but like I don't know, I more and more I'm liking the battering ram on the Batmobile with a bat face. I kind of like that idea.
Yeah, the Dick Sprang Batmobile. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We got a comment from Gothos Mansion who said, "I remember the exact moment I became a Batman fan. My mom sat me in front of the television and said, 'I think you'll like this.' My five-year-old eyes widened when Batman and Robin arrived in the Batcave via the bat poles. The Batmobile, all black and red and shiny, intrigued me even more. When Batman started the Batmobile and fire spit out of the tailpipe, I was hooked for life. My mom was thrilled because I was eager to learn to read after seeing Batman comics on the spinner racks. Since the 1966 Batmobile had such an impact on me, it is still my favorite. For comics Batmobiles, I have to go with the 1970s, early 80s Batmobile that very much resembled the C3 Corvette. I don't know if I love C3 Vets because they look so much like the Batmobile, or vice versa. James Bond is my favorite movie series, and he's had some great cars. Smokey and the Bandit is my favorite non-Bond movie, and I love Bandit's Trans Am. Even so, no real-world car is more beautiful to me than the C3 Vet, and I think my Batmobile fondness affects my decision. True, and somewhat sad, story, my dad bought a black 1977 Corvette when I reached driving age. He used the excuse he was buying it for me, but kept it for himself. After the 1989 movie, a lot of kids pointed at it and yelled, "The Batmobile!" There were shots of the Batmobile in the 1989 movie that made it look similar to a C3 Vet, but that capsule, protuberance, whatever, on the front of the Batmobile ruined it for me.
Yeah, the turbine thing in the front. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I like the Neil Adams Corvette-y Batmobile, too. That's pretty sharp. Yeah, and kudos for pointing out Smokey and the Bandit. I appreciate that. So, Brett Young from the Fantastic Four said, "I never read this issue before, so I dug it up on Infinite Ultra Humanite." All I have to add is that Batmobile is a damn sweet ride. Yeah, it's pretty cool. Especially, actually, like we said, I think he likes driving two different Batmobiles because the artist drew it differently in different panels. But hey, you know, so.
An anonymous Aussie said, "Aussie, point of order. Tom Taylor wrote the new origin for Ace the Bat-Hound. I can't abide Tom King getting the credit for the great comic." So the story I'm thinking of is from the rebirth era of it's Batman Annual number one from the rebirth era, like 2016 or something. And that story is definitely written by Tom King, or at least he's the one credited to it. So if Tom Taylor wrote a different Ace the Bat-Hound story, I'm not familiar with that one.
Is the one you're talking about the one where he was the Joker's, like, a pit dog, and Batman takes him home to Alfred? Yeah, that's the one I read, too. So that's Tom King. Yeah. So I do like some things Tom King wrote. There you go. So yeah, I don't know. Maybe Tom Taylor wrote a different origin for Ace. It wouldn't surprise me. DC's, you know, their continuity at DC is, you know, I know they're trying to straighten it out, but yeah. Martin Gray from the blog Too Dangerous for a Girl said, "It's always a treat when Nightcast swings across from some podcasting gargoyle and with a story I never heard to boot. This came during my non-Batman phase, which came around about the time No Man's Land got very silly and Batman began bullying his sidekicks. I probably have enjoyed this. What's odd is that I have a nagging, not quite memory of some other story centered on a childhood toy of Bruce Wayne. Any ideas? Or was it some other DC orphan? There are a few. Maybe it's a Citizen Kane thing. Favorite Batmobile, the Batmobile of 1950. Dig that crazy bubble." So there's your, yeah, that same Batmobile again. Mm. Do you know what story he's talking about? I can't think of it.
It seems vaguely familiar, but I can't think of what he might have been. No, I can't think of it.
Yeah. In the animated series, Batman has all the Gray Ghost memorabilia in the Batcave because it inspired him, you know. So there's that. But beyond that, I can't think. Yeah.
Doug Adamson from the Monitor Tapes, a Crisis on Infinite Earths podcast, said, "While Martin and I have met and live less than an hour away on public transport, Mark Miller, I believe, moved to Ireland for tax benefits. He might have moved back to Scotland in the meantime, but since I have always had an issue with his self-promotion and public persona versus the work he actually produces, I'm not sure we'd see eye to eye. Maybe cross the street to avoid each other. As for the best Batmobile, all day, every day is the supercar Norm Brayfogle versions. I love it so much I was able to get the Corgi Toys boxes for the two based on his designs signed by Norm on his trip to Edinburgh Comic Con in 2015, I think it was. There's the Corgi one that you mentioned, or two of them.
Yeah, I forgot that was in the comments. So yes, that's yeah, that's very cool. He got both of them signed, and of course we lost Norm Brayfogle, so no chance of that happening again. So that's great, Doug. Episode number 48 was Legend of the Dark Knight number 42, Hot House Part 1 and Batman and Robin Year 1 Part 4. Gothos Mansion wrote in on this one and said, "Hot House was reprinted at least once in Batman Arkham Poison Ivy trade paperback. Considering how little Ivy appeared in Batman titles between her debut and her star-making turn in Batman the Animated Series, there weren't a lot of stories to pull for the trade. I first saw Poison Ivy in a Super Friends Golden Book written by E. Nielsen Bridwell. When the text referred to Ivy as a Batman villain, I wondered why I had not heard of her." Yeah, actually, I've got an article for 13th Dimension coming up that kind of explores how the Batman Animated Series made Poison Ivy a big Batman villain, and she really wasn't before that. So, yeah, keep an eye out for that one. It should be coming up next month. So.
Nice.
Or late at the end of this month, I mean to say.
Tim Price said, "I know I've read Legends of the Dark Knight 42 before and started remembering it on this reread. The only thing I noticed this time is how P. Craig Russell kind of downplays Ivy's beauty. There's no attempt to glam her up. I wonder if that was the point, rather than start her as an irresistible seductress. She's a science nerd getting the better of Batman. The next issue will tell if that follows through. I can't repeat it enough. Thank you guys for giving me this reminder to read Batman and Robin Year One. I really meant to follow it when it came out, but just lost track and then didn't want to catch up. What a fool I was. It's so great. And yes, the drama of Dick's life and the social worker are almost better than the fighting the villain. This has been a joy, and you get the credit for me reading it. Or the blame, maybe? Happy to have that influence on you one way or another, Tim.
Yeah, in DC, we expect a check for, you know, sales for that. No, I'm just kidding. Bucky749 said, "We know Batman's two favorite heroes are Zorro and the Grey Ghost." There's the Grey Ghost again. "If there was a Brave and the Bold-style team-up comic starring the Grey Ghost character, would you read it, and who would you like to write and draw it, and who would be his guest stars for the first three issues, and would the comic be in color or done in black and white? Well, I would definitely read that. Yes, I'd read anything with the Grey Ghost. Who would I want to write and draw it? Well, I think just based on, I don't want to steal Ryan's thunder, but I feel like somebody like Matt Wagner would be great to, to do that. And his guest stars, you know, I'd probably want to mix it up and have, you know, it'd be cool to have him, you know, meet, maybe, the vigilante, the Greg Sanders vigilante, just to have a little, like a pulpy kind of, if he's set back in the past, you know, that's what I'm figuring. He's still set, you know, in the past, have him meet him. Let's see, Green Lantern, Alan Scott, that'd be cool. And, I don't want to steal all your characters, so I don't want to say what I was thinking of. And Starman, and Ted Knight Starman. Let's go with that. So.
Very cool. For the writer and artist, I would say Bob Gale and Bill Sienkiewicz.
There you go.
No, I mean, if we're making things up, I would write it myself. And for the art for a Grey Ghost team-up series, I mean, I like Matt Wagner. That would be a good choice. But if not Matt Wagner, maybe Francesco Francavilla. The first three guests for him to team up with, it would be Grey Ghost and the Crimson Avenger, Grey Ghost and the Blue Beetle, and Grey Ghost and the Green Lantern.
Yeah.
Just so we can stick with just chromatic team-ups.
And Shag's like, you know, Grey Ghost and no Red Bee?
Brett Young said, the biggest connecting line between P. Craig Russell and Chris Samnee is they are both expert storytellers. Half the time, the dialogue is unneeded. Amazing work.
Yep. Well said. Good point. Yep. Episode 49 was Hot House Part 2 and Batman and Robin Year 1, Number 5. And Rob McCarthy said, nope, Ivy's not in love with Batman. That's Catwoman and Riddler's job. Fathers are a big thing with Wade. Superman, Batman, Captain America. What if Dad was a superhero? Well, yeah, but, well, I think fathers are a lot. I mean, Jeff Johns is the original father issue guy. Yeah, in comics, I think, you know. And I don't know. I think Batman Talia's in love with Batman. And, you know, so Poison Ivy can be in love with Batman. Batwoman was in love with Batman. Everybody's in love with Batman, even if he doesn't have time for romantic love because he's Batman, you know, so.
Yeah, father issues are, I mean, I think in almost all literature, all stories, it's just one of the, it's part of the human condition. So, yeah, everybody has those issues. But
yeah,
especially when you're dealing with, like, strong, like, physically dominating but often emotionally repressed superheroes. Yeah, of course, there's going to be some dad issues there.
Yeah, even Spider-Man has dad issues via Uncle Ben, right?
So, right. Bucky749 said, I've been reading Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and they have crossed over with Batman. If the Ninja Turtles ended up in the world's finest comics, who would they team up with? Bucky, your questions are going too far afield from Batman. I'm not going to answer this one. I'm not even going to think about it. Sorry.
I'll say Batmite and Mr. Mitch's Pitlick, just for fun.
There you go. Good enough.
Brett Young said, thanks for the sports shout out, fellas. Yes, I was listening, but for the record, there are no other birds. Go birds.
Dr. Ange of the Supergirl blog Comic Box Commentary said, Phil Sylvain and Ivy's link to Jason Floronic Man Woodrue are from the Neil Gaiman Black Orchid miniseries. In that, Gaiman has all of DC's botanists, Isley, Sylvain, Woodrue, and even Alec Holland, all studied at the same place. That's kind of Roy Thomas-ish.
Yes.
Roy Thomas created all those characters, too. Sylvain definitely goes off the grid based on events we learned there. As a big fan of Black Orchid, it was cool to hear Sylvain's name dropped, so I'll need to hunt these down.
Yeah, we were just talking. Cindy and I have just recorded a podcast, and we were talking about, like, basically, I think somebody mentioned in the comments about, you know, E. Nelson Bridwell was also just as bad at Roy Thomas about, like, making everything connected. There's a lot of comic writers who really like to do that, and they kind of even, well, I know Neil Gaiman's not on the pedestal he once was, obviously, but, you know, even somebody that was once lauded as him, you know, they go a little too far with making everything connected, I think, sometimes, so... Sean Ross, wow, I've heard of that guy. From Peacebound and Down, the Wonder Woman podcast said, Chris and Ryan, I am loving your coverage of Batman and Robin Year One. I was able to buy the series over the course of a couple of sales, paying about $12 total, which is a steal given how wonderful this series is. Mark Waid continues the through line of most of his work, which is stories that celebrate what we love about characters while maintaining high stakes. And adding Samnee's art, whew, amazing. I have another modern recommendation. A few years ago, DC did a series of prestige format one-shots called One Bad Day, each of which features a different villain. While the Riddler issue gets the most acclaim, and it is great, the Clayface issue is amazing. I can't recommend it highly enough. Keep up the great work. This is my favorite listen each month. Wow, that's high praise. Well, thanks, Sean. And yeah, I'll have to check those out. I remember when those One Bad Day books come out, but I honestly didn't pick up any of them and read them. I'm sure they're on the DC Universe Infinite Ultra Humanite, as Brett says, app. So I'll have to check those out there. Yeah.
I read the Clayface one based on his recommendation in this comic. It's a good story. Yeah, and thank you, Sean. Thank you for saying that this is your favorite listen. I hope you like this one, this episode.
Yeah, yeah. If you don't, then you know you need to stop with the self-loathing because you're a good person. So
we got a comment from Paul Kane again, who said, "Your conversation about Poison Ivy got me thinking. At the beginning, she was this lovesick, weak female, as were most of the female characters then. And to this day, I'm still amazed they did not use her on Batman 66. Her first appearance was in April 1966. Anyway, it is amazing the evolution of her character in the 2000s, and not just as Harley's girlfriend. She is a real interesting character in and of herself. I am behind on her current series, but the fact that it has run so long speaks for this. For example, she is the only character my daughter-in-law likes to read about."
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, I was saying that a while ago. She has become one of my favorite Batman characters, and one of the I was so resistant to the idea of like sort of villain redemptions and the kind of Magneto was right aspect, but she was one of them where as more time has passed, as I've grown older, I'm like, I don't see her as such a villain as I would have used as I would have before. So. Yeah. And yeah, her recent comic is really good, and her appearance on the Harley Quinn animated series is amazing, too. So.
Martin Gray writes in to say, "Call me old-fashioned, but I'm not big on Poison Ivy as Swamp Thing in a bikini. It makes her too powerful for Batman to realistically defeat. Update her original MO, make her an Agatha Christie-like mistress of plant poisons. The Wade Samnee book is, as Peppermint Patty's dad would say, a rare gem. I hope we do indeed get a year two. Top show." Yeah, I think, you know, that's an interesting take, Martin, but I feel like most people really like this modern version of Poison Ivy. It seems like a lot of people do, even people who don't normally read comics. So, yeah, I think she's who she is now.
And our comments from the last episode, episode 50, where we covered Detective 500 and Batman and Robin Year 1, issue 6. Rob McCarthy said, "Best Batman? Well, my smart guy brain says, well, it's Dark Knight, of course. But my fanboy brain loves the first Croc story, the Batman-Hulk team-up, the player on the other side, and Brave and the Bold 191.
Well, there you go. Yeah, all great stories. And yeah. I mean, I knew people would say, that's not the greatest Batman stories ever told. But yeah, it wasn't clickbait, but I knew I'd get people talking. So there you go. Rob Kelly from this very network said, "Not that I haven't been enjoying the modern recaps, but of course I was super excited to see you were tackling an Alan Brennert Batman story this month. Nothing else needs to be said about it at this point. It's a stone cold classic. While the Phantom Stranger often skipped meetings and came and went when he pleased, kind of like Stella in that way, he did once declare, 'I am a member of the Justice League, am I not?' So he got all the benefits like discounted movie tickets and health insurance." So there. And Rob had both a Justice League blog and a Phantom Stranger blog at one point, so he ought to know. So there you go.
Gothos Mansion said, "Whenever I'm asked to pick my favorite Batman comic, I go with either the Strangest Cases Treasury, the Strange Apparitions trade paperback, or the Tales of the Batman Len Wein book. I will probably name Batman the Bronze Age Omnibus as my favorite Batman comic once it gets released. Multiple great stories in those books, and I don't have to choose just one favorite. Back to Detective 500, To Kill a Legend is an awesome story, and if I made a list of my 50 or so favorite Batman stories, I'm sure it would make the cut. However, I only rank it as my third favorite Alan Brenner story, after the Batman and Robin of Earth 2 story in The Brave and the Bold 182, and the Batman Catwoman story in Brave and the Bold 197, which is my favorite Brave and the Bold of all time. I also love the cover for Detective 500. I bought a promotional poster of it on eBay. Batgirl is my pick for the most egregious absence on the cover in... Batgirl is my pick for the most egregious absence on the cover and in the issue. Sure, she is on some of the covers used in the background. That was not enough representation for her. I was coming out of my Girls Have Cooties period, and I missed getting my monthly dose of Batgirl when she was absent from issue 500. I kind of had a little crush on her then, and that lasted until... Well, I'll let you know when it goes away.
Yeah, good point. I mean, I think, you know, there's a Batman Dead Man story that Robin's also in Detective 500. They could have swapped Batgirl in for Robin in that story, and because Robin's already in the Kill a Legend, and that way Batgirl could have been in Detective 500. That was a missed opportunity. So
yeah, we didn't get a chance to talk about our the latest chapter of the Todd McFarlane DC Universe action figures on this episode, but I did just want to shout out our buddy David A. Gutierrez sent me the Batgirl figure that is on display on my shelf right now. Very cool figure.
Yeah, it's a very, very nice classic Batgirl figure, Barbara Gordon. Yeah. Ido Bosnar wrote in to say, I'm with Gothos Machin in that To Kill a Legend ranks lower for me than the stories in Brave and the Bold number 182 and 197. However, if I were to draw up a list of the top 10 greatest Batman stories, at least four of them would be written by Brennert. And the one from the aforementioned Brave and the Bold number 197, the autobiography of Bruce Wayne, would likely to be number one. Yeah, I can't argue with that, guys. They're all great. And, you know, 182 is my favorite comic of all time. But I just feel like that To Kill a Legend is the better Batman story, you know, because that's a team up with Batman and Earth 2 Robin, which, of course, since it's Batman and Robin, it is also a Batman story. But, you know, you get my drift. Yeah, so...
Bucky749 said, I think the greatest Batman story I've read is probably The Long Halloween, with second place being the Batman Green Hornet crossover. Those are good picks. Bucky then also asked us if we have been reading Astro City, and if we got the chance to write Astro City, what characters would we write? I had no interest in answering this question or thinking about it that much, even though I'm a fan of Astro City. But our previous guest, Sean Ross, did a Astro City podcast once upon a time. So we invited him back here to answer Bucky's question. Sean, come on back here. Do you have an answer for this one?
Yeah, hey, thanks, guys. I do. Great question, Bucky. I co-hosted with Dr. G, the Man of Nerdology, an Astro City podcast for a while, actually. We covered the first mini. We covered the second series, which was like 22 issues. And then we covered a lot of the third series. So it's one of my favorite series of all time. It's brilliant. I love Astro City. I love Astro City in particular for its focus on, you know, pre-existing templates. And Busick covered, I mean, it's hard to think of a template he didn't cover in all of that work. But the one thing I would say that I would love to have seen him and Brett Anderson tackle is the female sidekick of a major hero. Because we have the male sidekick, we have the Confessor story. Which is the Confessor arc is one of the most famous arcs of Astro City. Confessor is sort of the Batman character. Alter Boy is sort of his Robin, and it's a brilliant story. And we get other stories of female characters. Definitely Busick and Anderson don't shy away from that. But I would love to see like a spoiler type story from DC Comics or Cassandra Cain, kind of Batgirl. That like young female protagonist, that definitely is something I would have wanted to see from Astro City. And, you know, would have been a blast. I mean, I love Spoiler. I loved her in the Tim Drake Robin series. Actually, quick modern shout out. Like the new Titans book that's out right now looks like she's going to join that team, which will be a lot of fun. So yeah, that's what I would do. Good question, Bucky. Any answers for you guys?
No.
No, just Spoiler.
Since we also brought you back, what other podcasts besides the Astro City one can listeners find you, since we forgot to ask you earlier?
Well, that's awesome. I appreciate it. So I am the host of Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. It covers the greatest era of Wonder Woman, the reinvention of the character in 1987 by George Perez and others. It features a guest on every episode. We cover each issue in depth. We talk about George's brilliance as a comic creator, as an artist, about the template he built for Diana, which is the template that exists today, And it's a lot of fun, a lot of secret questions, a lot of silly stories from the guests and from me, and then, you know, some Wonder Woman thrown in for good measure. So yeah, and thanks again for having me, guys. This was a blast. I get to talk Wonder Woman a lot. I don't get to talk Batman, and I love Batman.
Thanks a lot. Thank you, Sean.
It was great.
Oh, no problem.
Super Captain wrote in to say, hard to think of a single issue Batman story better than To Kill a Legend. Although for me, Batman number 400, Resurrection Night, comes closest. As far as longer storylines, Nightfall and The Long Halloween are the gold standard for me. Dan Jurgens' recent Batman First Night is pretty good as well. I really got to get to reading that. I really got to get on that.
You do. I mean, to say nothing of like the modern like monthly comics that are coming out, which includes like Batman Detective, obviously, and Absolute Batman, which is better than I would have ever imagined it to be. But yeah, in terms of just limited finite stories, the Batman and Robin Year One that we've been covering, Batman Dark Patterns, and Batman First Night have all been really, really good. All very different flavors, different styles, different depictions of the character, but all of them outstanding. And yeah, so definitely we've had a few people ask us to cover First Night, and I think we probably should at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Keen said, To Kill a Legend is my all-time favorite Batman story and has been since I picked up this issue off the rack. I would also argue it is the best Batman story, but there have been so many great ones that it is hard to really rank and differentiate between stories like this and Batman Year One, say, not to mention the other Brenner stories mentioned above. The story could have ended one page earlier and it would have been good, but the ending of young Bruce being inspired to ultimately become Batman for very different reasons is just brilliant. It is a moving and fantastic ending that is up there with the best endings of any comic story. And the art by Giordano is fantastic. I can see Paul Levitz in the office saying, wait until you read this script. And Dick reading it and saying, yeah, that's mine, and doing it justice. Super on model is a good way to put it. Just complements the story in a perfect way. Chris, how could you not have had this issue right off the rack? I would have thought it would have just teleported into your house, or you would have been born with an advanced copy.
good question. I don't know. I was buying Detective. I had the issue before, the issue after. Some grubby little sucker beat me to the rack that day. That's all I can tell you. So, Dr. Ange wrote in to say, this is a great Batman story for sure. And for a done in one, it might be the best. The Robin-Batman dynamic in this story is just a wonderful layer. I will say that if we go beyond the done in one and base purely on what Batman stories I go back to reread, I would say Year One and the Englehart Rogers are the best Batman arcs. As for Batman and Robin Year One, Wade has been on fire since he came back to DC. He just gets the characters. As you say, his take on Dick Grayson is perfect here and in World's Finest. And yeah, if you're going to go beyond just a one issue story, one part, then yeah, I can't argue with Year One or of course Englehart and Rogers, which we have all covered on the show, of course, and we gushed and gushed about them. So.
And our last comment came from Martin Gray, who said, I've nothing fresh to say about the Alan Brenner story. We all know we all love it, and yep, I don't want a sequel. But just think, with the 20-year origin cycle, Brenner could have given us two more spins on this story by now. That would have been interesting.
That's true. That's right.
Oh, yeah. All right. That wraps up the feedback and episode 51 of Batman Nightcast. We will be back again next month to continue our coverage of Batman and Robin Year One with issue 7. And we will start a new story arc featuring a villain. I'm not going to tell you who he is. I'll just say that his name rhymes with Mac Blask. See if you're smart enough to guess who I'm talking about. In the heat.
Batman Nightcast is a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. Feedback for the show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also find Batman Nightcast in the Fire & Water Network on Facebook, Blue Sky, and other social media platforms.
If you enjoyed this episode, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast to support Batman Nightcast or your other favorite shows on the Fire & Water Podcast Network. J. David Weider does it. Why don't you do it?
As always, thank you for listening.